an empty chair, I went to sit and felt a fork jab my thigh. "Excuse me," cried Millard. But Miss Peregrine made him give it up anyway, sending him out to put on clothes. "How many times must I tell you?" she called after him. "Polite persons do not take their supper in the nude." Kids with kitchen duty appeared bearing trays of food, all covered with gleaming silver tops so that you couldn't see what was inside, sparking wild speculation about what might be for dinner.
"Otter's Wellington," one boy cried. "Salted kitten and shrew's liver," another said, to which the younger children responded with gagging sounds.
But when the covers were finally lifted, a feast of kingly proportions was revealed. A roasted goose, its flesh a perfect golden brown, a whole salmon, and a whole cod, each outfitted with lemons and fresh dill and pats of melting butter, a bowl of steamed mussels, platters of roasted vegetables, loaves of bread still cooling from the oven, and all manner of jellies and sauces I didn't recognize but that looked delicious. It all glowed invitingly in the flicker of gaslight lamps, a world away from the oily stews of indeterminate origin I'd been choking down at the priest hole. I hadn't eaten since breakfast and proceeded to stuff myself silly. It shouldn't have surprised me that peculiar children have peculiar eating habits, but between forkfuls of food, I found myself sneaking glances around the room. Olive, the levitating girl, had to be belted into a chair screwed to the floor so that she wouldn't float up to the ceiling. So the rest of us wouldn't be plagued by insects, Hugh, the boy who had bees living in his stomach, ate under a large mosquito net at a table for one in the corner. Claire, a doll-like girl with immaculate golden curls, sat next to Miss Peregrine, but ate not a morsel. "Aren't you hungry?" I asked her.
"Claire don't eat with the rest of us," Hugh volunteered, a bee escaping from his mouth. "She's embarrassed."
"I am not," she said, glaring at him.
"Yeah, then eat something."
"No one here is embarrassed of their gift," Miss Peregrine said. "Miss Densmore simply prefers to dine alone. Isn't that right, Miss Densmore?"
The girl stared at the empty place before her, clearly wishing that all the attention would vanish.
"Claire has a back mouth," explained Millard, who sat beside me now in a smoking jacket and nothing else.
"A what?" "Go on, show him," someone said.
Soon, everyone at the table was pressuring Claire to eat something, and finally, just to shut them up, she did. A leg of goose was set before her. She turned around in her chair, and gripping its arms, she bent over backward, dipping the back of her head to the plate. I heard a distinct smacking sound, and when she lifted her head again, a giant bite had disappeared from the goose leg. Beneath her golden hair was a set of sharp-toothed jaws. Suddenly, I understood the strange picture of Claire that I'd seen in Miss Peregrine's album, to which the photographer had devoted two panels, one for her daintily pretty face and another for the curls that so thoroughly masked the back of her head. Claire turned forward and crossed her arms, annoyed that she'd let herself be talked into such a humiliating demonstration. She sat in silence while the others peppered me with questions. After Miss Peregrine had dismissed a few more about my grandfather, the children turned to other subjects. They seemed especially interested in what life in the 21st century was like.
"What sort of flying motor cars do you have?"
asked a pubescent boy named Horace, who wore a dark suit that made him look like an apprentice undertaker.
"None," I said.
"Not yet, anyway."
"Have they built cities on the moon?"
another boy asked hopefully. "We left some garbage in a flag there in the 60s, but that's about it."
"Does Britain still rule the world?"
Not exactly." They seemed disappointed. Sensing an opportunity, Miss Peregrine said,
"You see, children, the future isn't so grand after all. Nothing wrong with the good old here and now.
I got the feeling this was something she often tried to impress upon them, with little success. But it got me wondering, just how long had they been here, in the good old here and now?
Do you mind if I ask how old you all are?
I said.
I'm 83,
said Horace. Olive raised her hand excitedly.
I'll be 75 and a half next week.
I wondered how they kept track of the months and years if the days never changed.
I'm either 117 or 118, said a heavy-lidded boy named Enoch.
He looked no more than 13.
I lived in another loop before this one, he explained.
I'm nearly 87,
said Millard, with his mouth full of goose drippings, and as he spoke, a half-chewed mass quavered in his invisible jaw for all to see. There were groans as people covered their eyes and looked away. Then, it was my turn. I was 16, I told them. I saw a few kids' eyes widen. Olive laughed in surprise. It was strange to them that I should be so young, but what was strange to me was how young they seemed. I knew plenty of 80-year-olds in Florida, and these kids acted nothing like them. It was as if the constants of their lives here, the unvarying days, this perpetual deathless summer, had arrested their emotions as well as their bodies, sealing them in their youth like Peter Pan and his lost boys. A sudden boom sounded from outside, the second one this evening, but louder and closer than the first, rattling silverware and plates.
"Hurry up and finish, everyone," Miss Peregrine sang out, and no sooner had she said it than another concussion jolted the house, throwing a framed picture off the wall behind me.
"What is that?" I said.
"It's those damn cherries again," growled Olive, thumping her little fist on the table, clearly an imitation of some ill-tempered adult.
Then I heard what sounded like a buzzer going off somewhere far away, and suddenly it occurred to me what was happening. This was the night of September 3rd, 1940, and in a little while a bomb was going to fall from the sky and blow a giant hole in the house. The buzzer was an air raid siren sounding from the ridge.
"We have to get out of here," I said, panic rising in my throat. "We have to go before the bomb hits."
"He doesn't know," giggled Olive. "He thinks we're going to die."
"It's only the changeover," said Millard with a shrug of his smoking jacket. "No reason to get your knickers in a twist."
"This happens every night?" Miss Peregrine nodded.
"Every single evening," she said.
Somehow, though, I was not reassured.
"May we go outside and show Jacob?" said Hugh.
"Yes, may we?"
Claire begged, suddenly enthused after 20 minutes of sulking.
"The changeover is ever so beautiful."
Miss Peregrine demurred, pointing out that they hadn't yet finished their dinners, but the children pleaded with her until she relented.
"All right, so long as you all wear your masks," she said.
The children burst out of their seats and ran from the room, leaving poor Olive behind until someone took pity and came to unbelt her from her chair. I ran after them through the house into the wood-paneled foyer, where they each grabbed something from a cabinet before bounding out the door. Miss Peregrine gave me one, too, and I stood turning it over in my hands. It looked like a sagging face of black rubber, with wide glass portholes-like eyes that were frozen in shock, and a droopy snout that ended in a perforated canister.
"Go ahead," said Miss Peregrine.
"Put it on."
Then I realized what it was, a gas mask. I strapped it over my face and followed her out onto the lawn, where the children stood scattered like chess pieces on an unmarked board, anonymous behind their upturned masks, watching billows of black smoke roll across the sky. Treetops burned in the hazy distance. The drone of unseen airplanes seemed to come from everywhere. Now and then came a muffled blast I could feel on my chest like the thump of a second heart, followed by waves of broiling heat, like someone opening and closing an oven right in front of me. I ducked at each concussion, but the kids never so much as flinched. Instead, they sang, their lyrics timed perfectly to the rhythm of the bombs. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, bang, bang goes the farmer's gun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run. Bright tracer bullets scored the heavens just as the song ended. The kids applauded like onlookers at a fireworks display, violent slashes of color reflected in their masks. This nightly assault had become such a regular part of their lives that they'd ceased to think of it as something terrifying. In fact, the photograph I'd seen of it in Miss Peregrine's album had been labeled Our Beautiful Display. And in its own morbid way, I suppose it was. It began to drizzle, as if all that flying metal had riven holes in the clouds. The concussions came less frequently. The attack seemed to be ending. The children started to leave. I thought we were going back inside, but they passed the front door and headed for another part of the yard. "Where are we going?" I asked two masked kids. They said nothing, but seeming to sense my anxiety, they took me gently by the hands and led me along with the others. We rounded the house to the back corner, where everyone was gathering around a giant topiary. This one wasn't a mythical creature, though, but a man reposing in the grass, one arm supporting him, the other pointing to the sky. It took a moment before I realized that it was a leafy replica of Michelangelo's fresco of Adam from the Sistine Chapel. Considering that it was made from bushes, it was really impressive. You could almost make out the placid expression on Adam's face, which had two blooming gardenias for eyes. I saw the wild-haired girl standing nearby. She wore a flower print dress that had been patched so many times it almost looked like a quilt. I went over to her and, pointing to Adam, said, "Did you make this?" The girl nodded. "How?" She bent down and held one of her palms above the grass. A few seconds later, a hand-shaped section of blades wriggled and stretched and grew until they were brushing the bottom of her palm. "That," I said, "is crazy." Clearly, I was not at my most articulate. Someone shushed me. The children were all standing silently with their necks craned, pointing at a section of sky. I looked up, but could see only clouds of smoke, the flickering orange of fires reflected against them. Then I heard a single airplane engine cut through the rest. It was close and getting closer. Panic flooded me. This is the night they were killed. Not just the night, but the moment. Could it be, I wondered, that these children died every evening only to be resurrected by the loop, like some Sisyphean suicide cult condemned to be blown up and stitched back together for eternity? Something small and gray parted the clouds and came hurtling toward us. A rock, I thought, but rocks don't whistle as they fall. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run! I would have, but now there was no time. All I could do was scream and dive to the ground for cover. But there was no cover, so I hit the grass and threw my arms over my head as if somehow that would keep it attached to my body. I clenched my jaw and shut my eyes and held my breath, but instead of the deafening blast I was bracing for, everything went completely, profoundly quiet. Suddenly, there were no growling engines, no whistling bombs, no pops of distant guns. It was as if someone had muted the world. Was I dead? I uncovered my head and slowly looked behind me. The wind-bent boughs of trees were frozen in place. The sky
was a photograph of arrested flames licking a cloud bank. Drops of rain hung suspended before my eyes, and in the middle of the circle of children, like the object of some arcane ritual, there hovered a bomb, its downward-facing tip seemingly balanced on Adam's outstretched finger. Then, like a movie that burns in the projector while you're watching it, a bloom of hot and perfect whiteness spread out before me and swallowed everything. The first thing I heard when I could hear again was laughter. Then, the white faded away, and I saw that we were all arranged around Adam just as we had been before, but now the bomb was gone, and the night was quiet, and the only light in the cloudless sky was a full moon. Miss Peregrine appeared above me and held out her hand. I took it, stumbling to my feet in a daze.
"Please accept my apologies," she said. "I should have better prepared you."
She couldn't hide her smile, though, and neither could the other kids as they stripped off their masks. I was pretty sure I'd just been hazed. I felt lightheaded and out of sorts.
"I should probably head home for the night," I said to Miss Peregrine. "My dad'll worry."
Then I added quickly, "I can go home, right?"
"Of course you can," she replied, and in a loud voice asked for a volunteer to escort me back to the cairn.
To my surprise, Emma stepped forward. Miss Peregrine seemed pleased.
"Are you sure about her?" I whispered to the headmistress. "A few hours ago she was ready to slit my throat."
"Miss Bloom may be hot-tempered, but she is one of my most trusted wards," she replied. "And I think you and she may have a few things to discuss away from curious ears."
5 minutes later, the two of us were on our way, only this time my hands weren't tied and she wasn't poking a knife in my spine. A few of the younger kids trailed us as far as the edge of the yard. They wanted to know whether I'd be back again tomorrow. I made vague assurances, but I could hardly wrap my mind around what was happening at this moment, much less in the future. We passed into the dark woods alone. When the house had disappeared behind us, Emma held out an upturned palm, flicked her wrist, and a petite ball of fire flared to life just above her fingers. She held it before her like a waiter carrying a tray, lighting the path and casting our twin shadows across the trees.
"Have I told you how cool that is?" I said, trying to break a silence that grew more awkward by the second.
"It isn't cool at all," she replied,
swinging the flame close enough that I could feel its radiating heat. I dodged it and fell back a few paces.
I meant it's cool that you can do that."
"Well, if you speak properly, I might understand you," she snapped, then stopped walking.
We stood facing each other from a careful distance.
"You don't have to be afraid of me," she said.
"Oh, yeah?
How do I know you don't think I'm some evil creature and this is just a plot to get me alone so you can finally kill me?"
"Don't be stupid," she said. "You came unannounced, a stranger I didn't recognize, and chased after me like a madman. What was I meant to think?"
"Fine, I get it," I said, though I didn't really mean it.
She dropped her eyes and began digging a little hole in the dirt with the tip of her boot. The flame in her hand changed color, fading from orange to a cool indigo.
"It's not true what I said. I did recognize you."
She looked up at me.
"You look so much like him."
"People tell me that sometimes."
"I'm sorry I said all those terrible things earlier. I didn't want to believe you, that you were who you said. I knew what it would mean."
"It's okay," I replied. "When I was growing up, I wanted so much to meet all of you. Now that it's finally happening..." I shook my head. "I'm just sorry it has to be because of this."
and then she rushed at me and threw her arms around my neck, the flame in her hand snuffing out just before she touched me, her skin hot where she'd held it. We stood like that in the darkness for a while, me